This is Embodied, our show tackling sex, relationships, and your health. I'm Anita Rao. Here in the United States, we incarcerate people at a higher rate than any other country in the world. When a judge locks someone up, it is not just that one person serving a sentence. Families and loved ones suffer the punishment too. Economically, they lose a source of income and take on the cost of phone calls, travel, and basic goods like soap or a notebook. Emotionally, the cost is incalculable. Yet despite the hardship, relationships persist in prison.
It's so hard to share one's emotions and what's on your heart and in your mind over the telephone in a short 15-minute prison phone call. So we started writing letters together, and we started sharing about ourselves. And these, again, were more seeds that were planted to continue to nurture our marriage that had been broken. It wasn't fixed right away. It had to happen in time. Susan had to start trusting me again. She had to start seeing that I was changed and that there was a future to us.
Thanks to the exorbitant cost of phone calls and the long drive to visitation, romance flourishes in prison through the old-fashioned art of letter writing. An expert in that art is with me now. Hey, Stephen.
Hello.
Stephen Green was sentenced to life without parole and incarcerated in California for almost 28 years before receiving a commutation. After transitioning out of prison, he moved in with his wife, Satina, who was also here with us. Hey, Satina, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. This is the first time we've had two couples on Embodied, and I am just so, so excited to hear a story from both of y'all's perspective. So I want to start way, way back at the beginning. I know that you two were sweethearts in middle school, but a lot of time passed before you reconnected. Satina, tell me about reconnecting with Stephen once he was in prison.
We reconnected. We were together through junior high and high school. And then there was about a 10-year break. So from about 18 till about 28. I wrote letters here and there, and we remained friends. I went through a divorce, and so I started writing Stephen again just to see how he was doing, and our relationship picked up from there back in 2001.
Stephen, what was your reaction when you got that letter from Satina?
Well, I was extremely excited and happy. I just didn't know how long it was going to last. It's kind of the sad thing about it.
Tell me more.
Well, relationships like those walls are built in prison. They're not built just to keep people in. They're also built to keep people out. And so I think there's this wear down, effect that happens with the relationships. So even though her writing and her wanting maybe to reconnect and to come visit, I always felt that like it was one day going to be like, I can't do this anymore.
Because, yeah, at the time that you all reconnected, you were serving a life sentence without parole. So reconnecting meant that whatever relationship that you all had, it was going to always be separated by those walls.
Yes.
So, Satina, I mean, what inspired you to reach out knowing that there may not be a chance that you all would be able to be in the same place again?
Steven's my first love. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, I had went through a marriage. It failed, he was the one, my heart was always with him. And so at that time, you know, I was already in my late 20s and I've already experienced life. And so for me, I was just like, I don't care if this is the rest of my life. Like, I want to be with him. I love him. And, you know, this is the sacrifice I'm going to make for me to be happy.
So how did it progress? So there was letter writing. There was a bit of an exchange over letters back and forth. When did the visit start and how did that go?
So the visit, I was supposed to come and visit in January. I have three children from my first marriage. They were in a car accident and so with their father. And so I didn't show up. And so Stephen, I'm sure, felt stood up by me because there was no way for me to call him to tell him what had happened. So he finally called a few days later to find out what happened, why I didn't show up. And so then I came in March, and pretty much every other weekend from March of 2001 until he was released, In 2019, I visited faithfully every other weekend.
Wow. Stephen, so what were you feeling after that first visit didn't go as planned?
I felt that that was normal, right? Like that maybe she had the second guessing of her own decisions and grew cold feet, so to speak. And it was, pretty much like this is how it's going to be. Like, what do I expect when I'm sentenced to life without? Like, who do I expect with any type of common sense? No, like to dedicate their life to me, right? And I don't mean that in any disrespectful way. Obviously, I love my wife, but I just don't understand it. And so this is like one of the things, like the matters of the heart doesn't always have to make sense, I think.
And there's so much about those visitations that are so controlled. When people can come, what they have to wear when they're there, how long they're able to be there. And I want to hear more about that from y'all's perspective. But first, play you a clip from someone we spoke with who was incarcerated in North Carolina, who talked about some of the awkwardness of visitation for him. This is Travis Blackman.
She lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and I had been born and raised in Sampson County, North Carolina. She came at least once a year, mostly my birthday, to visit. While I was at Maximum Custody Prison, things were strict as far as visitation. You had to sit at least 3 feet apart. You only got two hugs and kisses, and they were divided up between arrival and departure.
So that's Travis Blackman, the author of COVID Behind the Wall, which he wrote while he was incarcerated at Orange Correctional Center here in North Carolina. So, Satina, tell us about those visits from your perspective. What is it like, and what are you able to do and unable to do?
Visits are definitely very controlling. It's one kiss and hug at the beginning of the visit and one kiss and hug at the end. We were fortunate enough that we were able to sit next to each other. So we could hold hands, we played games. Clothing was very strict. There was certain colors you couldn't wear, certain type of clothes you couldn't wear. So basically, I had created my own prison. This is what I wore for prison visiting, and then this is what I wore for everyday life. So I had my own prison wardrobe. So it was hard. And then eventually, Stephen and I ended up having children while he was incarcerated. So that was another added stress with bringing in children into visiting as well. So it definitely visiting, they make it not pleasurable. There's a lot of restrictions of things you can and can't do.
So, Stephen, you mentioned feeling a bunch of hesitation at the beginning of is this gonna happen? Is Satina really gonna be willing to commit to me? You all are married, so I'm curious, who proposed to whom and how did marriage come into the picture?
I think more, I mean, from what I remember, right, that the marriage came more from her perspective, right? I wasn't like, it's so like hard for me to say, like, as time went on, I kept just thinking, I'm gonna get, like a Dear John letter, or I'm gonna call her and she's just gonna be like, hey, I can't do this anymore. Because it's so rare that relationships last, like, beyond 5 years. I mean, I think that's just normal, even out here on in the streets, like in the public, right? But especially in there with all the different added stressors. And so I just approached each visit and each time with her is just that this is my special moment with her. I'm going to spend it now with her, and I'm just going to enjoy it because I don't know when the last time it'll be when I get to see her again. And yeah, but from my perspective, the marriage and more of the commitment side of the relationship came from her.
Satina, what made you decide to commit? What was that turning point where you said, I want to commit to this person for my life?
I loved him and I didn't want to spend my life with anyone else. And so, yeah, it was me pushing. I know when I first brought up marriage, he was like, I don't know if I want to get married. Like, I don't want to do that to you. I'm never coming home. And I had basically told him, like, I understand your points, but this is what I want. I know what I'm getting myself into. And so, you know, we moved forward with the marriage, which I'm grateful for.
Okay, we're going to take a break and then we'll hear more of your story and we'll hear about how Satina fought for Stephen's commutation and what their life is like now that they are on the outside. But as we go out, I want to play a clip for you. This is Stephanie Robinson out in Western North Carolina, and she shared her story of how she imagined her own future while her husband Jared was serving a sentence last year. I'll play that clip and then we'll join you again after a short break. You're listening to Embodied from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's Stephanie Robinson.
Jared had said, don't let Granny get another papaw. And my grandson looked at me and looked at the phone and says, but we only have one papaw. And so I think that was my deciding factor that, you know, that's right. We only have one papaw. We only have, you know, we're a family and you have to stick together no matter what. So I just made up my mind that that's what I would do and I would help him. And in the end, things would just work out. And so far they have.
This is Embodied, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We just met Stephen and Satina, middle school sweethearts who reconnected when Stephen was serving a life sentence without parole. Stephen was on the inside, Satina was on the outside. But that is not the case for all carceral romance stories. Monet and Adriel Alvarado met while both serving their sentences at the same facility in Pennsylvania. They've been married for almost 5 years, and I am so excited to have them with me now. Hey, Monet and Adriel, how's it going?
Good.
Good, good.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. So happy to have you both with us. I would love to start off with y'all's love story. Monet, let me start with you and hear the story from your perspective. How did you all meet?
So we met in the prison laundry room on my way from picking up my fan from the prison commissary store. I decided to stop by the laundry room, and that's where Adriel was working at. And he approached me and complimented me on my eyebrows and asking me how did I do my eyebrows. I told him I used a big pen. And he was impressed by it. And as I was leaving out, he stuck his head out and he called me by my name. And I turned around and that's when he told me to start acting like a diva. And that's when I kind of knew he was a little interested. And after that, I just started like just going out of my way looking for him. And every time I see him, I would say hi. And eventually, a week later, I got moved to his unit. And a week after that, he just started writing and just went from there.
So, Adriel, a love story that begins in a laundry room. I love it. How did things progress from there? How did the courtship go?
I mean, it wasn't as easy as it sounds because I was a known gang member. And as we all know, that's all frowned upon, you know, gang members dealing with certain type of peoples and individuals. So at first, you know, I was hiding and sending letters and, you know, just sneaking around to talk to her. And, you know, at one point I was just like, the hell with it. You know, I'm going to just show my true feelings, her feelings, you know. So we started expressing what I was feeling, lust, before I jumped into anything, you know, especially in the position I was in as far as being a gang member. I didn't want to look stupid and it be, you know, something that it wasn't. But, you know, I took that chance and it was the right one. It came with hardship, but as far as dealing with officers and staff members, and so it was hard, but it was all worth it for her. Yeah, it was.
So, Monet, I mean, Adriel mentioned kind of getting some flack from guard members and some other people. And part of that was that you were sent to an all-men's facility despite making it clear that you are a woman. So folks perceived you and y'all's relationship in a very particular way in this prison. How were you treated in this space?
Pretty badly. I wasn't treated as the woman. I was just as any other man in prison. It was very rough for me. They didn't acknowledge my identity, my transition. They disrespected me on a daily. I was teased. I was, every time I walked through the hallways, they always were mocking me, the way I walk, the way I talk. It was very rough.
Did that affect how you all were able to kind of be with each other? Like, would you be punished for your relationship? And did that affect your ability to have a relationship?
Yeah. So it is against the rule for inmate to have a relationship with another inmate. So, yes, it was frowned upon, and it wasn't okay. So we would always get into trouble just for being with each other. And we would always get into trouble going to the hole because we was holding hands. Or one time a CEO accused us of kissing, which we wasn't kissing at all. And she wrote us up for that.
So, Adriel, I mean, what Monet mentioned, sometimes one of you all would be sent to solitary confinement because of your relationship or because of some other punishment. So how did you all communicate when you were physically, I mean, you were separated and isolated? Were you all be able to communicate in any way during solitary?
Well, yes, it was in one block, and the block is more or less like a horseshoe. So certain cells could look at certain, you know, cells that house other inmates. And, you know, me and Monet would send letters. We would tie strings on like envelopes and put like weight in it and slide it under the door to one another's cell. And we'll just tie each other's line up and send letters back and forth all day.
No way.
Yes. Tie it up and back and forth all day. You know, it was to the point that we got sent to the solitary confinement so much that we even requested, just keep us down here. You know, all we want to do is be together. You know, if that's be, you know, in between two doors, then that's fine. You know, as long as we could, you know, wake up and hear each other's voice, because that's what we used to do. We used to wake up and whoever woke up first was, hey babe, how you, good morning. And this is, you know, in front of hundreds of other solitary confinement inmates. So you know, it was kind of, you know, ballsy of us to express ourselves in that manner.
I mean, completely. And I'm curious, like, what were you all, how did you feel about kind of the future of your relationship at that moment when, you know, you're having to really fight for it? You're having to, you know, come up with these, you know, 1700 style ways of communicating with letters on strings. And I mean, did you, could you imagine a future for yourself at that point?
And you know, was kind of ironic of this. We based and built our future in that REHU. We talked about all this. We talked about marriage. We talked about traveling to California. And, you know, we did this. You know, we're doing it. We talked about this. And she said, Monet always told me that being with her, I will experience a whole different type of hate. And I understand what she means. And I've seen it and I've been through it, you know, and I would like to say that everything that Monet being in my life changed me completely. You know, so for what it's worth, which is a lot to me, you know, Monet really changed me for the best. I'm a better person than I was before I met Monet.
Monet, you all, I mean, there's so much love bubbling, obviously, as you're sending these letters back and forth over little strings, and your relationship grew and developed, and you all ended up getting engaged, I think, in the prison yard, which is just such an image to imagine. I would love to hear that story.
Okay, well, it was afternoon yard, so they called yard maybe like at 1:30 around there, and mind you, this is a yard, once again, with hundreds and hundreds of inmates. And these are men that rape, murder, steal, you know, everything you could think of is in that yard. And I wanted to show Monet how much she meant to me, that I could block out the whole world and just have her as my center of attention. And I got on my knees and I proposed to her in front of all these criminals.
Monet, what was going through your head and your heart at that moment?
I was kind of surprised because he was brave. It takes a lot of courage to do something like that. And it makes me feel proud. It makes me so happy that there's a man here who accepts me for who I am and who wants to love me for who I am. And that's something I always wanted in my life. Someone who understands me, who treats me no different. And I found him, and it's just an amazing feeling.
So you left prison first. Your sentence ended, I think, about 3 years before Adriel's did. So once you were on the outside, how did that change y'all's relationship?
So I was released July of 2016. It was very hard because they was just giving us the runaround. It was like a whole process they had to go through with the marriage, for one. It took us 3 months to actually get married officially. I had to do everything by myself. I have to go to another county to register for a marriage license because the city I was in, Philadelphia, they required two people to be present at the courthouse to get the registration for the marriage license. And but another county, like 2 hours away from where I live, they didn't meet the second party. And I was able to go there. I drove to Pottsville, PA, to the courthouse. I registered, and 2 weeks later, he got on the video conference with them and registered with them through that. And then waited a whole another 2 months for them to set up a whole date. And on November 22nd, 2016, we got married. It only lasted for 20 minutes. We made our vows and gave our kisses and they let us go. They didn't give us time to be together. They just kicked us right out.
Wow.
And then it's like another, it was like June 2017, I was able to get approved for a visit. And during those times, it was like really rough for me because I wasn't able to see him. I couldn't really talk to him on the phone. It was very hard.
I imagine, too. I mean, we've obviously talked about, you know, the ways that you all were able to find connection and find intimacy. But now that Monet is on the outside and Adriel is on the inside, I mean, Adriel, what changed for you in terms of your relationship? Was it harder to then be inside without her? Did it make you have any doubts about the relationship?
I really never had no doubts because Monet is a person that will say what she means and means what she say. And that was another reason why I fell in love with her, because I believe her. I trust her. You know, I really do trust her. And, you know, to say that for... Because I'm a person that is hard to trust, you know. It's hard for me to trust people. And, it was hard. She was by herself out here. I was supposed to be out here. You know, my case, because I had an open case. That's why I was back upstate. Didn't go as planned. You know, calling every day in them 15 minutes. You know, we would try to have a good time with it. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, it was problems always, you know, and... she needed help. You know, she needed me out there. She needed her husband. And, you know, all I wanted to do was what any other man would have did for their wife and their family. And, you know, that's to take care of them and be there for them. And that's all I wanted.
I spoke yesterday with a local activist who works with families dealing with incarceration. And she talked a bit about what she recommends for couples preparing for separation. And I want to play that for both of you and see if you have any reaction or response. So let's listen to Andrea Muffin Hudson.
I would tell people not to have an expectation of things being the way they were before incarceration, because men... even though they're the ones that are actually serving time and their loved one is serving time with them on the outside, they're serving two different types of sentences. men sometimes tend to not want to be engaged with their loved one because that makes them, as they could say, weak on the inside, because they're constantly thinking about their partner, their children, and things like that, and so they can't focus. So they try to cut folks off completely so they can, you know, do their time and then be done and then come home. When women, we're emotional, so we want that, we still want that emotional connection where we want, you know, to write the letters, we want to send the cards, and we want that stuff in return. But we have to be mindful that we very well may not get that in return, but we can still send the letters and the cards showing that we still care and love our incarcerated person no matter what.
That was Muffin, who is the director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund of Durham. Monet and Adriel Alvarado are telling their love story with me right now. So I'm curious to hear your reaction to that. Maybe let's start with you, Monet. You were surrounded by men during your sentence. Did you see gender or sexuality affect how people would express love or receive love?
Actually, men, they want attention. They look for a woman's touch, to hearing from a woman, you know. They look forward to a letter. I guess that's one of the reasons why sometimes some of them goes for the trans in prison, because that's like the closest thing to a woman in a way. Some of them doesn't have it, and some of them have to find some other way to fulfill their needs, I guess.
Hmm. Adriel, how about you? I mean, did your relationship with Monet affect how you communicated with other men in prison?
It sure did. People that I knew maybe since, you know, childhood, people, you know, other gang members, you know, people that I thought loved me, turned their back immediately for, you know, a situation that didn't concern them. You know, something personal in my life, you know, a person will stop talking to me that knew me all my life. But then on the same token, people that has never spoken to me.
Hmm.
You know, hey, you know what, that's kind of brave of you. And, you know, people that just made a mistake, you know, and most people make a mistake and you know, go to prison. You know, these are people, there's good people in prison, nevertheless. And, you know, that's who gravitated towards me, I guess, that they seen that I have nothing to hide. You know, all my cards is on the table, you know, so, I mean.
Yeah, and I mean, I wonder, I mean, you mentioned kind of the folks that showed up and came out of the woodwork. And were there, Monet, I mean, were there people that came up to you? I mean, do you think that your relationship helped other people who were maybe closeted LGBT people at the prison, whether they were staff or people who were incarcerated?
Yeah, I think that our relationship played a big role in that. When they see me and Adriel together, it kind of gave them the courage to be themselves, because they see how happy we are.
Mm.
And they see that we can be ourselves and we're not afraid to be ourselves. We don't care what people think and say. And that kind of gives them the strength, in a way, the strength to say, hey, this. That's what people say, excuse my language. And just be themselves. Just, I don't know.
Well, we are going to continue this conversation after a short break. Monet and Adriel Alvarado will stay with me, and Stephen and Satina Green will also rejoin us. And we're going to talk about reentry and what that was like for both couples. You can check out a live stream of our show on the WUNC Facebook page, and please stay with us. This is Embodied. I'm Anita Rao. How do you navigate romance despite forced separation through incarceration? We will get back to that conversation in just a moment. But first, we want to hear from you for next week's episode of Embodied on the Radio. We're going to be talking about inclusive fitness. In the pre-pandemic world, did you feel comfortable in gyms? How has your race, gender, or ability impacted your experience in the fitness space? Leave us a voicemail with your story, 919-980-5419, or email us, embodied@wunc.org, or send us a DM on Instagram or Twitter. We are at embodiedwunc. I'm talking today with Monet and Adriel Alvarado and Stephen and Satina Green. And we're going to continue our conversation talking about the challenges of when the prison walls come down and when everyone is home again. We heard from someone named Mark Hall about his experience of this reentry.
Toward the end of my 10-year prison sentence, I realized I was going to be entering Susan's world.
After years of distance, both couples had to figure out how to share a home and determine those hard questions. Does a toilet paper roll go up or down? How do we manage a household together? So Stephen, Satina, Monet, and Adriel, really thrilled to have you all with us. So Stephen and Satina, I want to start with you. Where we left you off, you had decided to get married. Stephen was serving a life sentence without parole. Satina, you fought for Stephen's commutation, and he was able to leave prison after serving for almost 28 years. What was that experience like for you of fighting for that?
You know, it definitely was something that was necessary. You know, I had first told him to apply for commutation, and he didn't really think that they happened, you know, or if they did happen, it was for people who had political gain. But more and more, Governor Brown started commuting more and more people, and I would send him in the commutations, and I'm like, please just apply for a commutation. And so I think with all my nagging, he decided to put in for a commutation. And I think just with the people that I met along the way, different organizations, the support, putting our story out there, putting his name out there, fighting for his freedom, you know, obviously helped.
So, I mean, Stephen, you came back home after close to 3 decades on the inside. We heard Mark Hall say he felt like he was re-entering his spouse's world, a world that wasn't his anymore. How would you describe that process of coming home and trying to build a life with Satina?
I would say I was like an alien being dropped off into another world, because I got incarcerated very young. I was 18 years old, so I didn't really know what it was like to be had no idea what it was like to be a husband or a father, or just who I was, you know, without all like the political ramifications of prison. Hmm. Right? Like inside, we have a very structured world. We know what all the rules are. We know what happens if we break the rules. And we know what happens, like when you're kind of like stuck, like in an arrested development, like you have to remain who you were at the time you were incarcerated. And so when you're trying to grow past that, you kind of really don't, even though you do change and people do understand different situations. But coming out, it's like you have all these now, oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do that. They're just choices. And I don't have to ask permission to go to the bathroom, or I don't have to ask permission to go to the store. Like I can just get in my car and drive somewhere. Very different reality for me. And then to deal with her expectations of who she not thought I was, but her expectations of the roles that I have to take. Like husbands act this way, fathers do this. And, you know, for me, sometimes I'm like, well, it doesn't mean I have to, but that's a different conversation, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, what you describe is institutionalization. It's kind of what prison is designed to do, which is retrain you in a really particular way that is so psychologically damaging and so hard to unlearn once you're back on the outside. And I wonder, Monet and Adriel, for you, I mean, are there ways that those psychological effects of incarceration show up in your relationship day to day now that you have to unpack and support each other through?
Well, as far as for me, a habit that I had to break, and it took like 2 months, was jumping into the shower with my shower shoes on. So I had to break that habit. And it was still little things. Me waking up at 6 a.m. out of nowhere, because more or less most institutions, you know, count time is around that time. And going to sleep early, and this little things that I had to shake off, you know. A big thing for me, and it's weird, I don't know why, was crossing the street, because the cars looked like they were coming too fast. So I had a, you know, there's no cars in prison. Some prisons, you don't even see cars, you know, so it was just the little things I had to get used to.
Monet, is there any of that that has affected y'all's relationship, or have you been able to support each other through those moments of disorientation or moments of trauma?
It was kind of easy for me to transition back into the street. I was able to catch on really fast, and from me being out here for 3 years, I was able to help guide him. And the only problems I still have is asking my manager for permission to use the bathroom.
Mm. Yeah. Satina, I mean, you have never been on the inside, so those rules are maybe not as baked in for you. So I wonder, I mean, did that mean that you had certain expectations for Stephen, that he would be able to kind of snap back into normal life, or how was that navigating that for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, as someone who's never been formally incarcerated, you don't realize how traumatic prison is for them. Hmm. And so I did have probably high expectations. I didn't think they were high expectations. You know, I thought, oh, this is easy. Like, you know, it's not that hard to do. But it actually is. Like, I didn't realize how prison really affects just everything on how, you know, we expect everyone out here knows how to do things. And so it's different for him to have to learn how to use a cell phone. And I do see, I would get frustrated easily. Like, why aren't, you know, you've been home for a few months now. Why aren't you getting it? And so I've tried to learn to have more patience. That doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely, reentry is not what I expected. You know, I didn't expect like a fairy tale. I knew there would be some ups and downs, but I just, I think for me, you know, it was a lot harder than what I thought reentry was going to be like for us.
How about negotiating intimacy? I mean, going from that environment where you're allowed to, you know, sit on the same side of the table and hold hands to an environment where, you know, you're living in the same house and you can be physically and emotionally intimate more often in whatever ways you want to. How did you all make that transition? That sounds difficult.
Yeah, I think for me, it's funny that I always worried about that. Like, when he comes home, like, is he going to want to be more sexually active than me? And it's, to me, I think it's been quite the opposite. I'm wanting to have sex more often than he does. But I think we've come to a compromise, you know, so that we're both happy with our sex life.
Is there anything, Monet and Adriel, about kind of negotiating intimacy in your relationship that you miss from your time incarcerated, when there were maybe more rules or restrictions, but you knew kind of what was off limits and what was on limits? Like, is there anything that's almost too much about having all of that freedom now after being used to a certain way of being able to interact for so long?
First of all, me and Monet, we snuck around. Yeah, we snuck around. We did crazy stuff. That's why, you know, we're like really known in the DOC and PA, because there's stories that we snuck around in the library. We snuck around in the cells. We used to rent other inmate cells because everybody knew where we lived at. So if we wasn't, you know, in eyes view, you know, they'll start looking for us and we'll be in other people's cell. And, you know, it never, you know, it was only the most probably like half an hour, you know, so it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't really. But when I came home, oh my God. Yeah, I mean, I had to throw in the flag a couple of times. Yeah, I did. I had to throw the flag. That's it. I didn't know it was like this.
Oh my gosh, Monet. What are your thoughts? I mean, what has it been like to kind of renegotiate what intimacy means, even emotional intimacy on the outside?
I mean, it's really different. I mean, the only thing is that we get to
just do whatever we want and tell everything we want. There's no more hiding.
Yeah. We're losing you a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's phone battery. You were saying there's no more hiding. And I mean, I guess I'd love to kind of close out the show kind of acknowledging that there are, you know, thousands of incarcerated people in our listening area and countless more loved ones who may be going through what you all have been through at a certain point of forced separation. Maybe they're in a stage now where they don't know when they're going to next be together or be in the same place. And I'd love to know maybe from each of you kind of a message that you would want to pass on to those who are doubting their ability to maintain a relationship, or kind of any advice about communicating and negotiating intimacy despite the forced incarceration. Maybe I can start with you, Stephen.
Well, I would say that, you know, these relationships, that sometimes they can be very one-sided, or like I like to say, you know, she has all the power because she was on the outside and I was on the inside. And so our relationship is one of economics, where if she didn't have money, then we weren't talking. And if she did have money, then we would talk, right? And that's just with dealing with like the phone calls. Mm. But that, and if you go into the visiting area, like you're able to visit, that takes money. So I would just say keep plugging away at it. I mean, that's what I did, regardless, because I didn't love her because she had money, that's for sure, because we don't have money like that. And she didn't have money like that. And she was a single mom, you know, raising five kids. So, but I kept sending letters anyways. She was the person I loved and is the person I love. And so I just kept plugging away. You treat them like the people that you love, right? And so you treat them with kindness and understanding and empathy. And it doesn't change when you get on the outside. There are different hurdles and different obstacles, for sure. But you keep that in mind, like empathy and kindness. And you treat them like someone that you really do love. And so that's what I did. And I try to continue to do that.
I mean, yeah, you bring up a point that we haven't really talked about much in the show, but that it's so expensive to have someone who you love who's incarcerated, to be able to communicate with them. Them calling you means you have to pay, and those phone calls can be really expensive. People can be hours away, and so driving to go visit them can be so expensive. And there's not really a ton of support or really any for families who are going through this. So, Satina, I mean, any advice from your perspective?
No, I guess my advice would be just like, you know, for those who are on the outside that have a relationship with someone incarcerated, like there definitely is sacrifices. Mm. And if this is a sacrifice that you're willing to make, you know, for someone that you love, it's worth it. It definitely was worth it for me. I'm blessed with a wonderful husband and two beautiful daughters with him. And, you know, it's something that we work at every day, inside or outside. Relationships take work, and it goes both ways. I always said, you know, with Stephen, it was easier because I was the one that constantly gave and he always took. And now that he's home, he's learning how to give and I'm learning how to take. So it's not such a one-sided relationship anymore. And so I just, for those that I know, there's thousands of families right now because of COVID that aren't able to see their loved ones. And it's been almost a year, and it's devastating to not only the wives and parents, but to the children, to not see their family, their fathers and mothers. And so I just, I guess my words of encouragement are, you know, even through these tough times, keep your family bonds strong with letter writing, phone calls if you can, video calls, whatever means to keep the family strong during these hard times.
Monet and Adriel, I only have about 30 seconds left, but any closing words of advice that you would give to folks who have a loved one on the inside right now?
Just always keep in contact with them. Let them know how much you mean to them, how much you love them. Keep their spirits high. You know, just try to be there as much as possible. And, you know, sacrifice in any relationship is, you know, not an issue, but it's something that's part of it. And, you know, once a person know how to sacrifice, then they'll be fine in their relationships.
Monet, do you have any closing words?
Just be strong. Just have faith. Eventually, you'll get your love back home. Just believe.
Well, I hate to say goodbye to all of you. I wish we had more time, but I hope you'll keep in touch. And thank you so much for joining me today. Monet and Adriel Alvarado will celebrate 5 years of marriage this November. Satina and Stephen Green will celebrate their 17th anniversary next month. Congratulations, and thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find more about everyone we talked to today at our website, embodiedwunc.org. You can also learn more about the other voices you heard today, Travis Blackman, Andrea Muffin Hudson, Mark Hall, and Stephanie Robinson. We'd like to give a special thanks to our friends at Ear Hustle, as well as Judith Van Wyk for help with today's show. All episodes of Embodied, the radio show, are at embodiedwunc.org. Our seasonal podcast will have new episodes coming out in March. Embodied is produced by Grant Hall of Mormon and edited by Amanda Magnus. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. Join me next week for more Taking on the Taboo with you.